You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 7th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jane Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone. How's everyone?
Quite good.
Quite well.
Hey, happy birthday to the Smithsonian Institution.
Yeah. They have the
and
best
happy
will.
Happy incipient birthday to Jay.
And Jay's the day after.
That too.
Happy birthday to the other whale.
And happy birthday to James Randi. Actually, today that we're recording, August 7th.
That's true. Yeah.
Holy shit. How old is he?
80.
111. It's my 111th birthday.
111. So what, James Randi's in the Smithsonian? What?
Not yet. And neither is Jay, as far as you know. Jay, how old are you going to be?
I will be 45.
Wow.
And I feel like I'm 20.
You act like you're 20, so it works out. Well,
Glad you noticed.
The Smithsonian was established in 1846 by an act of Congress that was signed by James K. Polk on August 10th. The Smithsonian was established thanks to the will of British scientist James Smithson, who left about $500,000 to his nephew. But in his will, he said that if his nephew dies without any heirs, then the money should go to, and I quote, the United States of America to found at Washington under the name of the Smithsonian Institution, an establishment for the increase and diffusion of knowledge among men. So kind of a general stance there, but it worked out pretty well after quite a bit of back and forth. Obviously, his nephew did die without heirs. And so the U.S. government took hold of the money, and it took several years for them to figure it out, about 10 years, I guess, for them to go back and forth and try to figure out what to do with the money exactly. But eventually the Smithsonian was established, and it's been going pretty strong ever since.
Pretty awesome.
Interesting factoid about Smithson, though, is that he had never stepped foot in America, and he had no apparent ties to America. And so it's kind of a mystery as to why he would bequeath all of this money to the U.S.
Did he just think that we needed it more?
Well, I've seen some reports that suggest that he was inspired by similar institutions in England. So maybe he looked around and he's like, there's too much competition here. I'm never going to have an institution with my name on it that, you know, really succeeds here. But America doesn't really have Jack. So I don't know. Maybe he just figured he'd go where the competition was light.
That's quite a risk he took, if you think about it. I mean, think about how that could have turned out. What if a bunch of creationists who might have been have some control or power at the time in the government would have established some sort of like creationist society?
Well, everyone was a creationist back then, Evan, because this is pre-Darwin.
I never thought of it that way. Did anybody disbelieve, Steve? I mean, I never heard of anyone actually just not buying into, you know, some creation myth. I mean, there must have been people that didn't believe in any of it.
There were scientists before Darwin who believed in evolution. They just didn't have a mechanism and they didn't know how it worked. But the fact that life changed over geological time predated Darwin. But in any case, I mean, you know, this was obviously before the creationist evolutionist debate. That really didn't occur until after Darwin.
And this was back when America had a decent number of scientists and science lovers who were actually in positions in the government. So
yes, the age of enlightenment, baby. Smithsonian Institution is the largest museum and research complex. It has more than 19 museums at the National Zoo and 9 research facilities. I lived in D.C. for 5 years during medical school and internship. And
did not.
We went to the Smithsonian all the time. I loved it. Those museums are awesome.
Yeah. It is an awesome
place. They are incredible.
And free.
And free. Yeah.
My favorite part was definitely the, what would you call them? Like the panoramas, like the mock-ups that they have of the different environments?
Dioramas.
The dioramas. Okay.
Yeah. Life-size dioramas.
And then one year we went and I noticed that there was a gorilla and I noticed a bullet hole on it and I realized that
Whoa.
Somebody went out and hunted all those animals. Yeah. They were hunted for display. And I got very sad because I just, you know, you didn't think my whole life growing up going to the museum that all those awesome animals I was looking at actually got killed to be in the museum.
I think the Air and Space Museum is the single most popular museum in the world.
That makes sense.
By foot traffic?
I don't know. how do you measure?
I don't know. That's what I'm wondering. How do you measure
by how richly
the billboard charts?
It's the most visited museum in the country. 8 million visitors a year, but just as in the country, I thought it was the world.
Not so impressive now, are you, Air and Space Museum?
Have you guys heard about the dead monk that's alive?
Oh my God!
Monk. Is this a bad joke?
It's a new and slightly depressing definition of alive.
Yeah,
I have fake corpses in my basement that look more alive than he does.
But, all right, so this
is—you sure they're fake?
Okay.
This is a Buddhist monk, Hambo Lama.
Wait, his name is Hambone?
Hambo.
Not
Hambo. Oh, Hambo.
Like Rambo.
But Hambo Lama Hambo. Is his title, and his name is Atigalov. He died about a century ago.
Moira.
And
are you sure?
He left instructions for his body to be exhumed after a few years. His
what
body
a
was
jerk.
Partially exhumed in 1955 and 1973, and then completely exhumed in 2002. And people report that his flesh is still supple. It's not decayed. It's as if he was freshly dead without any corruption or decay whatsoever.
So still not alive, just to clarify.
No, still
so
not
freshly
alive.
Freshly dead does not count as alive.
Yeah. Not sure how they got from he looks freshly dead to he's alive. I don't understand.
Not just alive. The word alive is in all caps. They're making a serious
it's a
point
super
about
alive.
Is that like insane? I think about it. We've seen some cracky, news item titles, but that has got to take the cake.
Yeah,
there's
creative headline writing, and then there's lying.
Yeah,
and that's
lying, and then like immediately disproving yourself in the article immediately.
Yeah,
like he's alive, so he's dead.
The editors at the National Enquirer are jealous about this headline. Yeah.
Somebody ought to put like a magazine in his hands or something, like even make it look like he's doing something. Come on.
Oh, you mean Weekend at Bernie-um?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Put some sunglasses on him. Some Tyson
goofy expressions.
So some people are claiming this is the only known and confirmed case of an imperishable body throughout the whole world. Of course, there's tons of other claims about imperishable or incorruptible bodies as well. None of them are true. In this case, this is almost certainly a case of self-mummification.
He's like that McDonald's hamburger that doesn't rot.
Yeah, because it's dry.
Yeah.
Right. His body apparently is full of bromine salts, which is a very powerful desiccant, so it would have been dried out. He made some kind of ritualistic preparations for his death, not documented. Nobody knows what he did. He could have easily had undergone some kind of process of self-mummification. There are several traditions where monks or holy people did that. There's a Japanese, and there is a Buddhist tradition. It involves a long period of starvation to remove as much fat from the body as possible. Sometimes a slow process of poisoning, in the Japanese version with arsenic. And then drying out the body after death, packing it with salt or something. And it does actually result in a pretty significant percentage of success in self-mummification. So in this case, that's almost certainly what happened here. This is not an incorruptible body. This is a mummy. You know, you dry out the flesh enough and it will not rot, just like the McDonald's hamburger.
Only significantly less delicious.
I would assume so. Probably will not test that. Mm-hmm. Right. But this is a common sort of miracle claim, you know, the incorruptible body. But there are no cases in the world of miraculous incorruptibility. It's always a physical phenomenon.
It sounds like this guy was a prankster. I was going to say that he was a con man, but I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that he loved a good prank, because from the way the article describes it, you know, he knew he was dying. He was like 75. He had this all planned, and he specifically asked them to exhume his body later.
Yeah, so it's his final magic trick.
Yeah, so he's totally doing this. And there's no way he could personally benefit from this trick. So it really was, I think, just a ha-ha gotcha, you know, that he could enjoy in his last years.
A good one, too.
Look, a century later, we're talking about him.
Yeah, good for him.
Did you guys notice he had a degree in medicine and he created an encyclopedia on pharmacology?
Yes.
Oh.
So he would have had the know-how on how to use pharmacological agents to do preservation and perhaps other things.
Yeah, absolutely. And interesting that you bring that up, Rebecca, because, again, the credulous reports are presenting the fact that he asked to be exhumed as evidence that he knew that he was going to be miraculously preserved.
Right.
But, of course, he could have also known that he was going to be mummified because he was doing it himself.
Right.
And with the instructions that he left. So it doesn't really mean anything either way.
Which of those makes more sense?
Don't bring reason into this. Come on.
Oh, you're right.
So speaking of hamburger, though, Bob, apparently we can grow burgers now. And I don't mean cows.
There's way too many joke possibilities. I'm just going to go with one and just get it out of the way. Where's the beef, right?
Yeah.
Comes to mind. Ha ha. Okay. Anyway, it looks like
I love 1984.
Cultured beef. Yeah. It looks like cultured beef burgers are getting closer and closer. I've been kind of tracking this for years now, and this is an interesting step. Recently, two volunteers gobbled up a burger that was made from meat grown in a lab. A bio Big Mac, if you will. It's expensive, close to $250,000.
Oh my God, Magnum.
Yes.
Did you get ketchup with that?
Actually, no.
It's a quarter extra for ketchup.
like the Australian zoo.
Oh my God. Remember we got burgers in Australia and there was a red thing on the burger. Like, is that a weird looking tomato? No, it was a beet. Of course a beet belongs on a hamburger, right? Oh well.
Rebecca, are you going to eat? Would you eat a lab grown burger?
Yeah. Yeah, I would in a second. I'd be mega curious about that.
I want to be a part of this. All right, if anybody listening to this show is a part of that study and wants me to videotape Rebecca eating a lab-grown burger, I will make a huge, huge deal out of it.
Yeah.
I'll make a YouTube series out of it, even if I only get it for 30 seconds of her
one bite at a time.
And I think we'll also need a couple $100,000 to pull this off. So please contribute and we'll put all the money right to that. So
that's what Kickstarter's for.
And also another $2 for some Pepcid, just in case.
And 25 cents for ketchup.
Well, I mean, cultured beef is one term that's being used to describe this, but my favorite way to refer to this, and people are using it, is schmeat, as in meat schmeat. I love it. So you'll see, if you read about this, you'll see it referred to as schmeat very often, which I think is awesome.
That's great.
So this was accomplished by Mark Post and his team at Maastricht University in Netherlands, and with generous donations, about €250,000, from Sergey Brin, co-founder of Google. So, wow, that's pretty awesome. And he didn't reveal his involvement until the very end. So I guess the question is, what did the brave volunteers think? First off, I don't think they weren't necessarily brave. I mean, there was really no risk, and I would have taken part of this in a nanosecond. But what they said was that it had the texture of meat, which may sound like damning by faint praise, but that is actually huge. The texture is incredibly important. What they said, though, was that it was lacking in flavor because it had no fat. And volunteer taster Austrian nutritionist Hani Rutzler said, "I would say it's close to meat. I miss the salt and pepper." So both of these guys that tasted it refused the conventional bun and condiments, which at first I was like, well, why? What? Have it? If you're going to have a burger, have a burger. But it makes sense that they had to concentrate on just the meat. So they had pretty much just the meat with very little else. And
yeah, you'd figure that that's what they would do to fully compare it to a hamburger. I mean, the reason why they didn't get like great reviews on its flavor was because they didn't put anything on it. I mean, it's just like eating a cooked hamburger off the grill, you know?
Yeah, but not even though, because I mean, this was just muscle meat. There was no fat and absolutely, it would impact the taste as you could imagine.
There's no gristle.
The taste though is incredibly unimportant. The fact that the taste was off isn't really important at all because it primarily was due to the fact that there was no fat in it. And that's actually an easy fix. You just take some of the stem cells and turn it into fat instead of muscle. Bang, you're done. So actually, they did achieve, I think, a lot, regardless of what some of the reviews were. So how'd they pull this off? What they did was they took some stem cells from the shoulders of two organic cows.
So made of carbon.
As opposed to the inorganic cows that are out there.
Nice, Rebecca. So
I like silicon-based cows.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, very nice.
Got a Whataburger. Ever eat a Whataburger?
Oh, nice. Nice. Very nice. Yeah, it's a little crunchy. So now taking cells, of course, that doesn't harm the animal. And they actually predict that one sample could actually potentially make 20,000 tons of lab meat from just one sample eventually when they really get this down. So they put the stem cells, which we've talked about before. These are the master cells that can pretty much turn into any other cell. They put it into a nutrient solution, which over 2 years grew into thousands of strands of meat. And that number varies from 3,000 to 20,000, depending which article you read. So that would obviously be a hell of a long wait at the drive-through. 2 years is unbelievable. But then, get this, it took the scientists 2 hours to form each individual hamburger patty. So why did it take 2 hours? The answer is very interesting.
Not good.
I just don't know what it is.
They're not good cooks.
So I don't know what kind of weird process they might have had to go on through. So right now, they can make processed meat or minced meat using this technique.
Like Klondike Cat.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Good reference, Steve. Oh,
nice. Thank you.
Going to make you. Minced meat out of that.
Bob.
Very good.
Yeah.
You said before that they could make 20,000 tons of meat out of one sample. Was that correct?
Yeah. Yes.
And then what? They just can't keep replicating it, or what happens?
Yeah, I'm not sure why there's a limit at all.
Because the line is not immortal. It accumulates DNA errors, I guess, over time.
Yeah, mutates.
Now, Mike, Bob, will we be able to eventually grow meat in the lab and have it be less expensive and most importantly, be less of a burden on the land, you know, resource-wise, than... Cattle take up a lot of land and need a lot of outdoor area to grow cattle. I said cattle, didn't I?
Yeah, Jay, that's actually a huge concern, and that goes to the benefits of this technology. I mean, not only is it just cool that they could, you know, one day grow a perfect piece of steak or hamburger or chicken or even kangaroo, but this technology could, you know, obviously help feed the world, and it could also, if that's not enough, it could help fight climate change. And then going to what you said, Jed, it could free up lots of land, preventing the slaughter of so many yummy animals. And also, don't forget bovine flatulence and all that stuff that can have a huge impact on climate change. So getting rid of that or minimizing that would be important. But Jay, did you know the Food and Agricultural Organization predicts that by 2050, worldwide meat consumption will grow 100%. It's going to double by 2050. And right now, animals that we eat take up about 70% of all agricultural land, not to mention the huge amounts of water and other resources. So clearly, one guy said that we are at peak meat right now. So clearly, demand is far outstripping what we're going to be able to do in the near future. So this is, to me, this is a no-brainer and a really fascinating way to start producing more food.
One thing that's interesting is that, so there's actually not, it's not bad that the meat is 100% lean. It's just muscle tissue in terms of like how healthy it would be. If you could find other ways to make it flavorful, like cook it with onions and salt and, you know.
Yeah, but Steve, the fat actually changes the texture as well.
I got you, Jay. I understand that. But I'd like to see if you could get it to the point where it's actually tasty with zero fat. I mean, I think that would have a certain amount of appeal because it's totally lean.
I don't know. The whole mouth feel with fat is going to be really, I mean, they've been looking for a fake fat to reproduce that sensation for a long time. That's really, really hard.
Throw
a little fat on the damn thing.
One step away from an omega-3 burger here. You realize this, right?
That would be disgusting. A fish burger?
I've eaten fish burgers
and they're delicious.
Yeah,
I don't know about a lab-grown fish burger.
We cook salmon patties here. They're actually quite good.
All right, look, here's my summary, okay? I fully endorse this. Not killing animals for food is fantastic. They find the absolute most delicious cow, and they just keep cloning that cow and making hamburger and steak out of that guy.
Don't they have to kill it to find out if it's the most delicious?
Yeah, we only have to kill that one guy.
They know all of them to find out which one was most delicious.
No, they know. There's already choice select. You know, cow farms and
you got those Kobe beef calves that they suspend and massage and all that good stuff.
But seriously, guys, it might be someday within our lifespan that animals don't have to be killed for meat anymore. That is epic. Congratulations, science. Thank you. And what did you do this decade, homeopathy? Suck it. What did you want to talk about gluten today?
What?
Are you segueing to another item, Jay?
I just did. So well, you, good, you, but you didn't
you
even
can't
know
do that.
You didn't even well, know, Steve.
All right, I guess I'll handle the gluten follow up. Last week we talked about
which we're calling the gluten hubbub.
The gluten hubbub. The difference between celiac disease, which is an autoimmune reaction to the gliadin in gluten, versus non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is a controversial entity and may not exist. But, and then short, within days of that, of our show coming out, the FDA finally, came out with their regulations concerning the gluten-free label on products. So now, in order for a product to label itself as gluten-free or no gluten or whatever, anything that indicates that there's no gluten, it has to have less than 20 parts per million of gluten. And what's interesting, so this gluten comes from wheat, rye, and barley. So anything made from those things that you then call gluten-free, the gluten has to be removed down to, you know, this 20 parts per million or less. One thing I found interesting is that you can also label as gluten-free foods which inherently don't have any gluten,
such as water.
You can have a bottle of water that's labeled gluten-free water for the completely scientifically illiterate consumer.
Yeah, or like rice cakes and things like that. I mean, the thing is that I guess there can be like little bits of gluten here and there, or it can be produced in a factory that also produces gluten stuff. But I find it funny to see like Chex Mix, like cereals that are all rice or corn based have gluten free on them.
And this is important. I mean, even though I think that, you know, the gluten free thing is a bit of a fad now. And I hate catering to that. It does tend to lend a little bit of legitimacy to it. However, because celiac disease is a real disease, and it's 1 in 100 people, it's 1% of the population. There's 3 million people in America have celiac disease. They really need to eat gluten free, and because of the proliferation of faddish gluten free, that actually flooded the market with products that are labeled gluten-free, but weren't really, really gluten-free. And so it became harder, ironically, for patients with celiac disease to know confidently that, you know, when they're buying something off the shelf, that it's labeled as gluten-free, that it really is. Because in some people, even a tiny amount of gluten can cause a significant reaction. So now, with the FDA regulations, it really will protect those people who suffer from celiac disease. So it was a necessary step. They had to do it.
Good.
Right.
All right. So, Jay, I'm going to segue back to you now. You're going to tell us about how long dolphins can remember stuff.
I really love dolphins. I've always loved them. I think they're, you know, not just interesting, but they're cool. Their behavior is cool. So many things about them is really interesting. And I think it's really based on the fact that they are definitely highly intelligent animals. I remember when I was a kid, I was fascinated by them using those underwater speakers to talk to the dolphins, or to, like, you know, not really talk to them, but to have some type of back and forth communication, or to inspire them to do things. And what's interesting about this news article that we're going to cover is that that same technology was used to help them discover the fact that dolphins actually do have names. They use their names to prove that dolphins have extended memories. And this is really interesting. So every dolphin, roughly between the ages of 4 months and about a year, select some whistle that becomes, for lack of a better term, it's their name. It is the thing they identify as themselves, and they use it to communicate to other dolphins. They vocalize their own whistle to other dolphins to identify themselves, and they use each other's whistle names to address each other, which is great, right? So that's why researchers are really sure that those are their names.
Yeah. Think about that for a minute. That is awesomely cool. Dolphins call each other by unique, specific names.
Brilliant mammals. Yeah.
This is important because two dolphins, Allie and Bailey, who knew each other 20 years ago, who were at the same facility, were recently tested, and their names were played to each other, and the dolphins had a reaction that researchers could use to prove that they were recognizing the name.
It wasn't just these two dolphins. They actually did a study that encompassed dozens of dolphins, all of whom showed this ability. It's really quite remarkable that, and they didn't seem to find an upper limit to how long a dolphin could go without knowing its friend but still recognize the name.
Yeah, so they had 50 dolphins, which they ran these tests on, and they got very positive results. It was a very successful study. You know, just to recap how they did it, they would use that underwater speaker, like I mentioned before, and they used dolphins from 6 breeding facilities and rotated the animals among themselves, and they were using the names of dolphins that they had recognized or identified. And then they were also just using other whistles that weren't names, and they were watching the reaction of the dolphins. And over the period of time of the study, they were able to deduce that the dolphins were definitely responding to the names that they were familiar with. And it was very complicated how the scientists had to chart down which dolphins knew which names of other dolphins and everything. They were, you know, watching their social behavior and knowing which dolphins were in captivity with the other dolphins. And there was, you know, pretty complicated series of events that took place in order for them to get this research done. But they did it, and they definitely proved that the dolphins recognize the names, respond to the names, and it's definitely a part of their language. Now, the fact that they have names, guys, does that make you think there are a lot of other things going on in a dolphin's brain that would elevate their perceived intelligence? Like, because it made me really think, wow, there's a lot more going on here than just, they're not just intelligent where they recognize each other, but they're using language. I mean, let's cut to it. That is language.
Well, yeah, there are other researchers that are developing a shared human dolphin language so that in the future that there's a chance that we could actually be able to communicate with dolphins similarly to how we communicate with chimps using sign language. And I think that it's completely feasible. I mean, as a complete layperson, I should say, knowing what little I know about dolphins. But, you know, dolphins appear to be just as intelligent, if not more so, than the average chimp. So, yeah, they definitely seem to have a language. And it's probably a language that we could one day be able to interpret and be able to communicate with them. It's really exciting.
The real question is, do dolphins ask each other if what they think is going on in the brains of those humans that yeah. keep feeding them
monkeys.
Fish?
Yeah.
Keep stealing them and sticking them in aquariums.
Yeah. Do you think their chattering means something?
You know, to get back to this study real quick, I think it's worth noting that the researchers didn't come away from this positive that they've discovered that dolphins remember their friends 20 some years later. All they can say is that dolphins recognize the name that these other dolphins were using, and they're responding to it in a certain way. But they don't know when the dolphin hears that name. Are they picturing that dolphin that it applies to? Are they remembering the good times eating fish together? You know, or
yeah.
is it just this reaction like, oh, that sounds familiar. What's that? You know, they don't know. And it'd be cool if it were the former, but you know, that they don't really know. That's something a bit more complex that they would need to do more
that's
studies
right.
to figure out.
So Evan, speaking of cows, you know, if we end up growing all of our beef in a vat rather than with cattle, then, you know, what are the aliens going to do? What are they going to mutilate?
That's a good question, Steve, because it's been happening for decades now, and that is the eternal question, I would say. But recently in the news, courtesy of the Daily Mail Online, a Missouri rancher has now found 3 of her cows mutilated in bizarre and unusual ways. And after ruling out every explanation under the sun, she's prepared to look further into the heavens toward a culprit more outlandish, better known as aliens or extraterrestrials. We have talked about this before, and Steve, I remember you first mentioning this when you were giving a lecture for the Connecticut Skeptical Society back in 1996, and you said something to the effect that you were stunned when you first learned about it, as if to say, why would ETs want to mutilate cattle? Like, it just absolutely made no sense. Mm-hmm. And you may have talked about it in the context of the logical fallacy, and specifically it's the argument from ignorance, which says when you have an unknown event, therefore you put in whatever you feel fits your worldview as to what it was, and there you have it.
Right.
So enter Lynn Mitchell. She's from Henry County, Missouri, and she says that this first occurred back in 2011, and the cow had its tongue completely excised along with one of its ears, and she assumed vandals, teenagers, you know, messing around were to blame. But then she found two more cows with mutilated genitals and missing organs. And then it happened again just this past July 9th. She found one of her best cows dead in her field, and she noticed its tongue was missing, and the cow's udder, anus, and reproductive organs had all been removed. 2 weeks later, so just recently, it happened again to two more of her cows. So that was it for her. She called in a veterinarian to inspect the cows.
No one had inspected them? Like, how many mutilated cows does it take before you call in an expert?
That's good.
Apparently, like, a half dozen.
Or do some sort of, I don't know, cursory search on the internet under mutilated cows to see what other historical references there might be to this very occurrence. Because there is, there's tons of reports of this happening. I mean, it's been happening for decades. Why these parts of the cows, though? I mean, what's going on? The eyes, ears, genitals, the organs, you know. So these are the softer areas of the animal, areas that, say, predators and scavengers can easily access as opposed to having to cut through the hide of the cow. And they tear away these pieces first. But when the vet was called in, they were unable to determine a cause of death, and the vet was surprised because these cuts in the animal were so precise, it almost seemed like surgery was occurring. So that's probably all that Lynn Mitchell had to hear to sort of get the idea that aliens must be the ones at work here, because who else would go around doing surgical cuts?
Crazy band of drunken surgeons.
Now, these cuts can happen. Exactly.
Okay.
These cuts happen for, well, various reasons. Well, frankly, predators and scavengers do have teeth and claws that can cut these things open. And what may look like surgery is actually, you know, just kind of your standard ripping that occurs when they go after these dead animals.
In addition, when the animal dries up after it's dead, those wounds will stretch and it will make the skin look very straight. So it makes it look like a straight incision when in fact it's just, you know, taking a rip and then stretching the skin.
Back in the late 1980s, the Washington County Sheriff's Department did an experiment that is well documented and sort of a point of reference for skeptics in regards to cattle mutilation as one of the examples as to what might be going on here. The Sheriff's Department placed a dead cow in a field and had observers watch what would happen over the next 48 hours. And they reported this bloating effect, Steve, like you said, stretches the skin, and it led to incision-like tears that would be otherwise mistaken as surgical cuts.
Yeah, I mean, what she's describing is the phenomenon that's been explained already. This is not even an anomaly. Soft parts being eaten, the organs being eaten, these rips and cuts, you know, that's scavengers. This is the work of scavengers. This is what happens to a dead cow left in the field. The notion that it's aliens is like doubly nonsensical. Doesn't need an explanation. And of all the explanations to pull out of your hindquarters, aliens? Really? Again, what are they doing?
Yeah. They've got nothing better to do. They've traveled light years to dissect our cows.
Well, interestingly, in 1979, the federal government actually investigated cattle mutilations under public pressure. And they actually had an FBI investigation producing this huge report, a very, you know, thorough report, which concluded that cattle livestock mutilations were due to scavengers.
Yep.
Yeah, no evidence of anything anomalous going on, let alone specific evidence for aliens.
And to make it worse, local sheriff's office refuses to rule out aliens either.
Yeah.
They said, we have to look at this from two sides. Some people believe there are aliens that are involved in this, or the possibility of the occult going on is the other end of the spectrum. I don't know. The farmers, the veterinarians.
Wait, those are the two sides?
Yeah.
The two sides are
could be aliens or cults.
Or a cult.
Could be voodoo.
Wow. All right, Evan, tell us about Who's That Noisy from last week.
Yep, playing for you right now last week's Who's That Noisy. Here we go. That is somebody playing, well, not, you can't say it's playing the drums because you're not really playing the drums. What you're doing is you're taking hammers and you're hitting rocks. These are rocks. They're known as the ringing rocks. Whoa. Have you guys ever heard of this?
Wow.
No,
so
what the hell?
What's the rock's properties?
That's a good question. Well,
just the property to rock.
They have the property that is actually right, Rebecca. They have the property of resonating like a bell when struck. And these rocks, or these rock beds where this particular recording was made, is from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. But there are other areas of the world in which similar sounds are able to be created from rocks. And they don't know exactly why they're able to do this, these particular rocks. There's been a great deal of controversy concerning it. There's been not enough testing done. There's only been one published scientific experiment, and this was back in the 1960s. A Rutgers University professor actually did some sort of test in which he was able to he recorded what the rocks sounded like when he was hitting them with the hammers and compared it to other rocks. I think he used five different rocks in total. And then he did a cross section. He was able to cut the rocks in half to kind of see what their properties was. And what he found out is that these rocks, the ones that had the ringing harmonics to it, were under stress. So the live rocks, or the ringing rocks, showed a distinctive expansion within 24 hours after they were cut. So think about that. You've cut this rock and this sort of expansion has occurred, which means that there was this tremendous sort of pressure occurring on the inside of this rock. The relaxation indicated that the rock was under internal elastic stresses, which were released by the mechanical sawing of the rock. He went on, the professor, that is, to make the observation that these rocks, which he called live rocks, were generally found towards the middle of those boulder fields, and they did not have contact with the soil or the shade of the surrounding trees. And then he theorized that slow weathering rate in dry microclimates of the field causes the stresses, because the outside skins of the boulder would expand due to the conversion of pyroxene to to clay, basically.
Interesting.
So much so that there were no correct guesses.
Really?
Okay, so here is this week's Who's That Noisy?
If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. And that simple statement is the key to science.
So there you have it. Send your answers, your guesses, to WTN@theskepticsguide.org. That is the email address for Who's That Noisy. Or go ahead and post it on our message boards, sguforums.com, and I wait with bated breath to hear your answers. Good luck, everyone.
All right, thanks, Evan. Couple of emails this week. First email comes from Scott Williams from Chicago, Illinois, and Scott writes, "Hi, Steve and the Rogues. I've been sparring over the past few days with several people on forums regarding the safety of the HPV vaccine. I've consistently been able to point out flaws in their logic, but one poster made a comment that sort of floored me with what she said. I have copied the quote in full below for you to look over, but the part I had a question about related to this line." Now, here's the quote from the person he's debating with. "HPV, human papillomavirus, is a virus, and a virus cannot live in an alkaline environment. This is proven every time you put chemicals in your pool to boost the alkalinity of the water to kill the bugs. Simple science to me. If you maintain the body's immune system to its optimum levels and have a body serum pH of 7.35 to 7.45, the body should rid itself of the virus according to scientific literature." That's the end of the quote. Scott continues, "This seems like a bit of woo logic to me, but maybe there is something I am missing, perhaps a kernel of truth buried beneath a pile of misinformation. If you could please respond with a brief discussion on the point she may be trying to make, I would appreciate it." Actually, Scott, there's no kernel of truth there. That is complete nonsense from beginning to end. Just about everything she said is complete bollocks.
Love that word.
Yeah. Virus cannot live in an alkaline environment. Well, what virus? Depends on how alkaline. That's kind of a nonsensical statement. The only thing I could really find on pH-sensitive viruses are all come from holistic, natural healing woo sites. There's like no science behind that. I'm sure, you know, if you alter the pH enough, you make an unfriendly environment for viruses, but viruses are pretty hardy little fellows. They're really just packets of RNA or DNA in a protein armor. You know, they don't really have like a complicated lifestyle. I suspect that in order to get your body's pH to a point that would actually harm viruses, you would be dead.
I mean, yeah, It surprises me that somebody who probably supports like all natural solutions to things uses as an example shocking your pool, because I grew up with a pool and we weren't allowed in it for a few hours after the chemicals were added, but I loved to swim. So I would sneak in and jump in and my eyes would burn out.
Well, here's the other thing. That's not how chlorine works. It doesn't work by making your pool alkaline. It works by breaking down into hypochlorous acid and hypochlorite ion, both of which disrupt the lipid cell walls of bacteria, which is what it's actually killing, not viruses. So it's wrong that it kills it by making it alkaline. It's wrong that it kills it by making it, that it kills viruses. It kills, I think where she's getting confused is that the effectiveness of chlorine is different at different pool pHs. And you do want the pool to be a little bit on an alkaline side with a pH of between 7 to 8, 7.4 being ideal. Then I like how she says, if you maintain the body's immune system to its optimum levels, how do you do that exactly?
Yeah.
Other than general good health, there isn't any way to supercharge your immune system. That's just all nonsense. And have a body serum pH of 7.35 to 7.45. Do you know what that is?
The pH level?
That's normal. That's the body's normal serum pH level, 7.35 to 7.45. So if you have a normal serum pH, you'll be immune to viruses.
No.
This is just confusing misinformation from WHO sites. Like, there's a whole alkalinity diet. You know, eat food to make your body more alkaline so you could fight off bugs. All pure nonsense. Again, if you actually ate something that threw your body's pH off of its normal, very tight range, your body has a lot of feedback mechanisms metabolically that keep your pH in a very narrow, healthy range. If your pH gets outside of that range, it's because there is something very much wrong with you. You either have a metabolic alkalosis or acidosis or a respiratory alkalosis or acidosis. Like, so drinking methyl alcohol or something, you know, toxic, something poisonous that throws off your body's pH, that makes you deathly ill. So it's just, again, she's like confusing a mishmash of pseudoscience, but there isn't a kernel of anything legitimate in there.
At least she didn't use quantum.
Yeah, shouldn't use quantum.
At least, yeah, that's the way we're judging things now. They could have said, but didn't say.
Vibrations, energy, resonance.
All right, guys. Well, let's go on with our interview. So we're sitting here now at TAM 2013 with Dr. Michael Mann. Michael, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
So, and Dr. Mann, you are well known as a physicist and climatologist, as the lead author on the 1999 paper, which described the hockey stick, the increase in temperature recently, and been somewhat of the focus of the global warming or climate change wars. I'll mention also author of the book, The Hockey Stick, The Climate Wars. So tell us about, let's start with the hockey stick. Tell us about that. How did you and your team, you know, come to that conclusion?
Sure. So this was a study that we published 15 years ago now, aiming to reconstruct how temperatures had varied in the fairly distant past. We only have about a century of widespread thermometer measurements around the globe. So we have this instrumental record that tells us that the globe has warmed, a little less than a degree and a half Fahrenheit over the past century. But what the instrumental record alone cannot tell us is how unusual is that sort of warming. And so we turned to what are known as proxy climate data, tree rings, corals, ice cores, to try to piece together the puzzle of how the climate changed in the more distant past. These are sort of imperfect thermometers, but they're the best sources of information we have. Trees record various climate conditions under certain circumstances, drought, temperature, how warm the summer is. Corals, their skeletons contain carbonate, which has oxygen that can come in two different isotopes. And based on the variation in those isotopes, we can learn something about the seawater in which those corals grew. Similarly with ice cores, we can look at the ice and the chemical composition of the ice. Mm-hmm. And so we try to use these natural sources of climate information to extend the record back in time. And when we did that, what we found was that the recent warming really is without precedent as far back as we can go. And in fact, if you look at the graph that results from this, you see relatively warm conditions about 1,000 years ago and a long-term slow cooling into the depths of what we call the Little Ice Age of the sort of 17th mm-hmm. through 19th centuries. And you might think of that as sort of a handle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the abrupt warming of the past century, which spikes up below any of the temperatures that we see in the past. And you might think of that as the blade of right. the so-called hockey stick.
And this correlates to the Industrial Revolution, I would imagine, roughly.
That's right. I mean, the spike in temperatures corresponds with the spike in CO2 concentrations over the past two centuries as a result of fossil fuel burning and other human activities.
So you said it's been almost 15 years now since that publication. Within the climatology community, among actual scientists who like do this for a living and know what they're talking about, presumably, this has been probably thoroughly worked over, replicated, et cetera. So what's the consensus of opinion? Is there one? And what is the consensus about the legitimacy, the validity of that data?
Well, I sometimes joke that there's no longer a hockey stick. In its place is a hockey league, because there are literally dozens of reconstructions of this sort that have been done over the in the intervening 15 years since we first published our study. And these studies make use of increasingly more rich networks of data that scientists have obtained. They use different kinds of statistical approaches to solve this problem. And in every case, these studies come to the conclusion that the recent warming really is without precedent as mm-hmm. far back as we can go. In fact, even farther now, some of these studies find that the recent warming may be without precedent for the past 12,000 years. Mm-hmm. And so this warming that we've seen really is unprecedented as far back as we can go with these sorts of reconstructions. And that conclusion that the warmth of the of recent decades is without precedent in the modern record, and that it can only be explained by human influences, by increased greenhouse gas concentrations from fossil fuel burning. That appears to be a very robust scientific finding. There's a scientific consensus now that that is true.
Have you done any studies or been involved in any studies also tracking solar activity sort of as a parallel, that you would put the two sort of one on top of the other and see what sort of graph that creates?
Sure. In fact, sometimes the critics of climate change will say, well, the recent rise in temperature could be due to increased solar activity. Well, we actually have records of solar output. We have satellite measurements of how bright the sun is that go back several decades. And prior to that, we have information from ice cores that collect certain isotopes, radioactive isotopes of carbon or beryllium that actually change over time in response to changes in solar output. And so we can reconstruct solar output back in time as well. And what you find is when you put the changes in solar output into a climate model, what the model predicts is that the globe should have cooled in recent decades. That's because solar output has been flat or has slightly declined. There have also been a few very large volcanic eruptions, which is a natural cooling effect. So the natural impacts on climate should have led to a cooling, and therefore they can't possibly explain the warming that we've seen in recent decades.
Even arguably, it might have been worse if the volcanoes hadn't exploded.
Well, that's right. The natural, what we call forcing, but the natural factors have actually offset some additional mm-hmm. warming that we otherwise would have seen. Now, the problem is that those natural factors can easily reverse, and it may be that instead they add to the warming in the future.
Is there any, are there any legitimate holdouts or, I'm not talking about the deniers, but, respected working climatologists who have other interpretations or who say that this is an artifact, or is that still any legitimate controversy with this, or is it pretty much settled science?
Well, there was a recent study. It was, I forget which journal it was published in, but it was a respected peer-reviewed journal, which assessed essentially all of the climate literature over, past decades. and concluded that there is now a level of consensus of about 97%, something you almost never find in science, actually, because scientists, by their nature, are sort of cantankerous. And
there's always that 5% hold.
There's always that. Well, that's right. And, you know, you have devil's advocates who, you know, so that's an amazingly high level of consensus when you actually look at publishing scientists and whether their work confirms the basic, you know, consensus of the scientific community that the globe is warming, that we can only explain it through human activity, increasing greenhouse gases from fossil fuel burning, and that we will see much larger potential changes in the future if we continue on this course that we're on. That's the conclusion of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. That's the conclusion of 30-plus different scientific societies in the U.S., the American Chemical Society, the American Meteorological Society, American Physical Society, and so on, all on record that climate change is real, that the globe is warming, that it's due to us, and furthermore, that it represents a risk if we don't do something to deal with the problem.
Right. The most frequent talking point I seem to hear from the climate change deniers seems to be that there hasn't been any warming for the last 16 years. And we know that that's BS, and we actually have talked about that on the show. But can you summarize for us like why that's BS? What mistake are they making when they come to that conclusion?
Sure thing. We're here at the amazing meeting celebrates you know, James Randi, the amazing Randi, who has made a career out of exposing the fakers, exposing sleights of hand. And this argument that the globe hasn't been warming over the past decade or so is based on the sort of sleight of hand that would even impress the amazing Randi. And it's based on taking a very warm year like 1998, which was boosted by a big El Nino. And so the temperature spiked up. And so, of course, after that El Nino disappeared, they went back down. And global warming has gradually increased the overall level about which these fluctuations occur. But if you take a relatively cold recent year as your endpoint, and you take that huge 1998 spiking temperature as your beginning point, then you can try to make it appear as if the globe hasn't warmed over that period. But you know, any mathematician or statistician or scientist worth their salt knows that that's the sort of cherry picking. That's the sort of disingenuous reasoning that has no place in legitimate scientific discourse. It's simply a sleight of hand.
Yeah, I totally agree. When you look at the graph, it's such blatant abuse of statistics and cherry picking, as you say. You're just predetermining your beginning and end point for.
And there's an irony there as well, because you know the our detractors, the climate change contrarians, or climate change deniers, those who deny the scientific consensus, will often cynically accuse the scientists of doing that sort of sleight of hand. And it's really projection. They're projecting sort of the sorts of things that they do in their mindset onto scientists. No self-respecting scientist would do something
like that. It's like an intellectual temper tantrum.
That's right.
And we get that from every class of denier. So you personally have been targeted by the deniers. The email scandal, you know, which turned out to be not such a scandal, but just a sort of a manufactured event. But so tell us, you know, what kind of trouble have they made for you professionally and personally?
Well, ever since we published this graph, the hockey stick, back in 1998, and then in 1999, we extended it. In 2001, the graph was featured in the Summary for Policymakers of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. That's the only part of this report that's read by the policymakers, non-experts. So suddenly this graph became very prominent in the climate change debate. It became an icon in the climate change debate. And again, the detractors, the contrarians, the deniers, one of their techniques to try to discredit the science and discredit the case for human-caused climate change is to attack the iconic results in the science. And because this graph had become an iconic result that told a simple story, you know, you didn't have to understand the physics of how a climate model works to understand what this graph is telling you, that there's this anomalous warming over the past century, and that it can only be explained by human activity. So climate change contrarians and deniers saw the need to go after that graph, to discredit that graph. And in part by trying to discredit the authors, and me in particular. And so they've engaged in, you know, a rather cynical, effort to try to discredit me and my mm-hmm. science that's gone on more than 15 years. It's the subject of my book, the Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, sort of the trials and tribulations of being a scientist, you know, somebody who never imagined being in the public sphere. When I majored in applied math and physics in college, you know, I wasn't on a career trajectory mm-hmm. to become, you know, a combatant in one of the greatest scientific battles that we've faced in modern time. The battle to communicate climate change in the face of a well-funded, well-organized, and rather disingenuous opposition, largely funded by special interests, in particular mm-hmm. fossil fuel interests, who don't want to see us take steps to regulate carbon emissions, which is the only true solution to this problem.
Yeah.
And so they've gone after the science. It's very similar to what the tobacco industry did decades ago to discredit the science linking their product to ailments, human, you know, health ailments.
They don't have the evidence to do, to counter
That's right.
the evidence. So instead they attack the messenger.
Exactly.
Last resort, it sounds like.
Exactly. They've given up. Some years ago, the sort of climate change denial movement gave up on even attempting to engage in an actual scientifically based discourse over this issue, because they knew they had lost the battle as far as the science is concerned. The science is in. And so all they had left were smear campaigns, innuendo, and, you know, and attacks.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you say that, your description of that, because we talked about this before. That was my sense, that climatologists were, you know, scientists working in this rather obscure field, I mean, who, you know, never in the public eye, and then suddenly they're in the midst of a raging controversy. And my sense was they weren't quite ready for it as a profession, and they got blindsided by, you know, the type of tactics
That's
that
right.
well-funded deniers can engage in. Whereas, like, for example, evolutionary biologists have had a century of experience confronting deniers. Do right. you think that you guys have just collectively as a profession, you're sort of on the, you've gone on that learning curve and you now realize what you're in for and how to deal with the public and public perception?
Yeah, it's sort of like a Boy Scout encounters a ship full of pirates.
Yeah.
That's not a very fair fight, is it?
Yeah, right.
Nope.
And that's sort of what it's like, right. Because scientists, you know, we are brought up to play by the rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certain rules in science. You know, you don't state your findings in absolutes that are unjustified. You state your findings often with layers of caveats and uncertainties. Mm-hmm. In our original hockey stick article, the words uncertainties and limitations appear in the title of the paper.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's, as scientists, we're actually very conservative, sometimes overly conservative, because we don't want to overstate the case. We don't want to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
right.
on the other hand, we face an opposition, climate change deniers, who have no interest in playing by the rules, where, you know, there's often no intellectual consistency whatsoever in the arguments that they make. And often you'll find the same sort of advocate, for fossil fuel funded advocates who are, attack the science of climate change. You'll find them at various times making completely inconsistent arguments. You know, they'll say, in one instance, well, the globe isn't warming.
Yeah.
And then the next day they'll say, well, okay, maybe it's warming, but, it's natural.
Yeah.
And then on another day they might say, well, you know, it's not entirely natural. But, you know, some of it may be human caused, but it's going to be pretty moderate. It's not going to really be a problem. Or they'll even go farther and say, you know what? It's happening. It's due to us and it's going to be good for us.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, there's nothing we could do about it.
And that's
yeah.
the final
yeah.
sort of, stage in the six stages of denial
right.
is, well, you know what? It's too late to do anything about it anyway. Full
right.
circle, coming full
right.
circle.
So how do you get 7 billion people who live on this planet to fix this problem?
Well, that's a great question. You have to start by ensuring that we have an honest discussion about, you know, the problem and what to do about it. There's room at the table for all sorts of, you know, views across the political spectrum as to how to confront the climate change problem. And I think it's great that there are conservatives now who are at the table mm-hmm. arguing for, you know, revenue neutral carbon taxes, free market driven solutions to, mm-hmm. you know, limiting carbon emissions. But unfortunately, you know, in our House of Representatives right now, in the U.S. Congress, we have a science committee that is led by politicians who reject science. They mm-hmm. reject the science of climate change. They reject the science of evolution. Some have joked, in fact, I've joked, that for the time being, at least, we need to stop calling them the House Science Committee. They're the House Anti-Science Committee.
Mm-hmm. But let's say they do eventually get on board, yeah. for example. Right. How do you get China? How do you get India? How do you get Russia and these other populous nations to do the same thing?
It's a great question. You can look at China, for example, which is now the largest emitter of fossil fuel emissions, carbon emissions. And depending on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, you can see different things there. It's true that they are, building a coal-fired power plant every 5 days or so. But they're also investing far more on renewable energy technology than we are in the U.S.
Including nuclear?
Including nuclear. And nuclear, that may have to be on the table. We can have, again, a good faith discussion about what options should be on the table. And I think nuclear has a place. We may take it off the table when we assess the various risks, because that's really what we're talking about.
Yeah.
We're talking about managing different kinds of risks. Fossil fuel emissions come with their risks, climate change in particular. Nuclear energy has other risks, and we have to make a decision as to, what risks we're willing to take and which risks, to take as we move forward. But, if you look at China, they are also having a serious discussion about passing a carbon tax. So they're actually much farther along in terms of potential policy changes than we are here in the U.S., where, the president recently announced a climate plan, some executive actions that he's going to try to take to deal with the problem. But really, that's sort of, that's whispering into the wind, because what we really need is a comprehensive policy for carbon. Yeah.
Yeah, it's too bad because this country has been sorely lacking a comprehensive energy policy for not just this administration or the last decades, far as I've been able to discern. And it's to the detriment of everybody.
That's right. I mean, and so, you ask, what's the ultimate solution? The ultimate solution is that we stop this silly debate about whether climate change is happening, which is unfortunately where our politics are stuck right now in the U.S. And we have that worthy debate that we need to have about how we meet our growing energy needs, growing international energy demand, in a way that doesn't threaten the health of the planet. And as I said before, it's a problem in risk management. But the only way you can do the right cost-benefit analysis is through an honest assessment of what the risks are. And we're not there yet in terms of U.S. energy and climate policy, unfortunately.
And it seems like public education is where that's going to have to begin. If we need the political will, that's going to derive from the public understanding what's going on. And it sounds like the other side, the climate deniers know that, right. And they're making a concerted, well-funded, again, effort to confuse, the public about this issue. So are we doing enough on the science side to educate the public about what's really going on?
Well, we're here again at the amazing meeting, which is, which brings together hundreds of people who are really committed, to, making sure that we teach, the public, children, but also adults critical thinking, how to sniff out disinformation, pseudoscience. And that's an important part of the problem. Part of why I'm optimistic is when I come to events like this and I meet so many great people who are really making inroads in that larger effort to educate the public about science, to educate them about critical thinking and how to sniff out pseudoscience. But it's a monumental task that we have ahead of ourselves.
Absolutely.
And it would be difficult enough in a vacuum, because teaching about science and critical thinking is tough in a world that's sort of hooked to the 24/7 news cycle and gets their information often from somewhat dubious sources. So it's already a difficult battle, but it's not even in a vacuum. We're facing a stiff headwind of a very organized, very well-funded disinformation effort, and that makes it all the more tough, but it makes our efforts all the more urgent and important.
Well, Dr. Michael Mann, thank you so much for sitting down with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. But before we go on with science or fiction this week, Jay, tell me about your weekend. What'd you do this past weekend?
I watched like 4 or 5 TV shows on Saturday, and then Sunday I slept until about 1. And oh, I'm sorry. That's my dream of what I could be possibly doing on the weekends. No, we wrapped the Ox shoot Sunday late afternoon.
Yeah, 4 episodes in 4 days. It was
nice
hairy.
Wow.
We had a fantastic cast and crew. I can't talk enough about how wonderful everybody was and how hard everybody worked. I thought that we did a fantastic execution of the scripts. And as we wrapped Sunday late, the morale was incredibly high. So everybody had a great time and there was a lot of new friendships made. So I got to just say that it was one of the best times I've ever had in my life. We are immediately clicking over to doing post-production. You know, Doug right now is getting all the files on a hard drive. And, you know, I was just looking at some of the raw footage today after I got home from work, and I'm just so excited. I can't
We watched some of the dailies. I didn't have time to watch all of it, but I saw some of the dailies, and just some of the scenes were incredible. I mean, Phil Hudson, our director of photography, actually knows what he's doing. And I mean, some of the shots he got were just great. Can't wait to see like a rough cut. So, when do you think the first episode's going to go up on YouTube? You're thinking like early October? Is that too ambitious?
Yeah, right now I can't really say. We just have so much going on, and I'd like to do this. I'd like to actually complete all 4 of the episodes and then launch them all at the same time. I think that might still be up in the air a little bit, but I would feel better just putting our heads down and getting it all done and doing it, editing the best way, not the episode per episode way. So I'll know more over the next couple of weeks, and I'll definitely let everybody know.
Yeah, we'll keep you updated as the post-production continues. But I will say that we captured hours of B-roll, interviews, behind the scenes, extra bits. Joel, who is also doing some of the special effects for us, was on the second camera, and he got a ton of interviews and stuff. So we will be putting up some snippets, some little teaser fun stuff that we did onto YouTube, and we'll probably also have some of that B-roll as premium content for our members. Speaking of which, if you are not aware of you can support the SGU by becoming an SGU member if you go to theskepticsguide.org and you'll see the membership page there. Jay and I made a bunch of fun membership levels. For example, the level at which you get access to the premium content is the Damn Dirty Ape level. But a lot of people go for the Vorlon, a lot of fleet admirals. A lot of people want to be fleet admirals. There's one level that nobody has gotten so far. So here, the levels are, Rebel Scum, Damn Dirty Ape, Cylon, Road Warrior, Fleet Admiral, Vorlon, Sandman, Replicant, Guild Navigator, Time Lord, and Starship Science Officer. I haven't seen a Time Lord yet.
We have one Guild Navigator.
We have one Guild Navigator, yep, and one Science Officer.
But he's a fantastic person, and he's a great friend of the show. Joe, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. But yeah, we had a great time coming up with those levels, and the graphics on that page are just awesome. I keep looking at it. And as a matter of fact, Steve, I wanted to tell you something real quick. I am working on a secret t-shirt design that is going to be in that genre of the way the graphics are presented on that page.
Oh, cool.
Yes, so I will be letting you see that soon, and hopefully we'll have that in the store at some point over the next month or so.
Yeah, we had lots of t-shirt ideas coming out of the Ock project, Ock the Skeptical Caveman, too. Maybe one of those might emerge at one point in time. Something we discussed last week, we made a pledge that we are now getting some sponsors for the show, so there will be occasional ads in the show. And some of our listeners asked, well, what would it take to pull the ads from the show? And so we came up with a specific answer. If we get 4% of our listeners to donate at the Damn Dirty Ape level on average, then we will take the ads completely out of our show. But before then, members of the SGU will get access to ad-free versions of the show, which we will make available in several formats, but at the very least, through a free app that we're developing for the SGU. That's in the works. We'll give you updates on that as it's fully developed.
And those will be available on Android and iPhone platforms.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move on to science or fiction. We have a theme this week. The theme is coffee. Everyone ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Coffee.
Here we go. Item number one. Scientists have developed a fully automated portable kit for testing the amount of caffeine in beverages. Item number two. Chemists have developed a process for making a strong alcoholic beverage from coffee grounds. And item number three, new research finds that pregnant women who drink coffee daily have a significant increase in the risk of certain birth defects. Rebecca, go first.
All right. Don't know any of these. They all seem very plausible. A kit for testing the amount of caffeine makes the most sense to me because I have heard in the past, I know that there was a guy, I think it was even on This American Life or something, there was a guy who had figured out a way to create a piece of paper that you could drop a little bit of coffee on and it would tell you whether it was decaf or not. And he was trying to sell it to sugar companies so that they could change their packaging to be that paper. So you could get a little packet of sugar, you could drop your coffee on it, make sure that it's decaf or caffeinated, whichever you prefer. So a portable kit to do it makes sense. Why not? Process for making an alcoholic beverage from coffee grounds. Again, why not? Prisoners can make an alcoholic beverage out of anything, so I've heard. So
I was going to say,
why not coffee grounds? Like, which leaves us with the pregnant women drinking a coffee a day significantly increases the risk of certain birth defects. Caffeine is a drug. So again, you know, it's a drug that has effects on your brain. So you can see how that would possibly have an effect on a developing brain. But that said, that one to me seems like the most obvious. And so therefore, maybe that one's the fiction. Maybe the surprise here is that they did a test and found that coffee is actually quite safe to drink as opposed to every other enjoyable food and beverage that pregnant women now have to give up or else be seen as horrific monsters who are doomed to give birth to a child with birth defects lest they stop eating everything but plain bread. So I'm going to go with that one as the fiction. Coffee is fine for pregnant women. That's what I'm going to say.
Okay. Jay?
So this first one about scientists being able to test the amount of caffeine, this portable test for the quantity of caffeine in a beverage. Absolutely. Why not? Why is that a big deal? The second one about the chemist who developed the process for making a strong alcoholic beverage out of coffee grounds. Again, why not? Why is that a big deal? Like they're going to, you know, use some type of fermentation process or whatever. Maybe it's just like alcoholic flavored coffee. I mean, coffee, you know, it's coffee flavored alcohol, you know, whatever. That doesn't seem like a big deal to me either. This last one about the research finds that pregnant women who drink coffee daily have a significant increase in the risk of certain birth defects. I actually am going to say that one is science as well. So
I can't move you.
I cannot pick a fake out of these three, Steve. You got me stumped here. So I don't think that caffeine has a big effect on birth defects because I think a lot of women drink caffeine while they're pregnant and there'd be a lot more birth defects.
All right, Evan?
Jay, your point was very good about that. I'd say it's between the pregnant women and the automated portable kit for testing. I'm going to put my nickel down. I will go with Jay and Rebecca and I'll say that it's the women who drink coffee. Birth defects is the fiction.
And Bob?
These portable testing kits for all sorts of different things are getting so common that caffeine, yeah. The process for alcoholic beverage from coffee grounds, that's just too cool not to be true. I'm not a big drinker, but I did a few months ago, I did drink some vodka with that was espresso flavored and it was awesome. So I kind of like that idea. The third one, the pregnant woman, women drinking coffee, I'm not buying it. Significant increase, that sounds a little suspect to me. And a certain birth defects, you know, granted, yeah, maybe they could be really obscure ones, but still, I'm not buying this one. So I'm going to say that one is fiction.
All right. You guys are all agreed. Yeah, it's all or nothing this week. Well, let's start with number one. I guess.
Oh, he's too happy, guys.
Yeah, he sounds really smart.
Okay. Yes. Well, let's start with number one.
In the back of his mind. Yeah.
Done. All right. Scientists have developed a fully automated portable kit for testing the amount of caffeine in beverages. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Hooray.
Yes, this is a lab on a chip. You guys ever hear of that?
Oh, yeah. That's what I
Basic technology of trying to put everything you need to do some kind of laboratory test into one little disk and or whatever so that it gets all automated. You know, you put the drop of blood or whatever on the disk, and then it goes through all the different processes it has to go through, and you get some kind of indicator as to the result right there. So they developed basically that for detecting the amount of caffeine in a liquid like coffee. So you could put a little drop onto the disk. It spins. It says it spins at 3,000 RPM. I'm not sure what the internal mechanism
stuff goes
is there.
Flying.
And then you get a color-coded response from green, no caffeine, through yellow, orange, and red. Red being a lot of caffeine. It's like kind of like a litmus test. You know, like you ever see the litmus paper with the different colors? You know, where the glucose strips.
Fourth grade science.
Yeah, the glucose strips where the different colors equal different amounts. Well, it's the same thing from green, yellow, orange, red, telling you different amounts. So it's not just the presence of caffeine; it tells you the amount of caffeine. So very interesting. And yeah, so do you guys know if you take coffee and you put it through a decaffeination process, how much caffeine is left in the coffee?
Well, it could be up to
23% of the original amount.
Could be 4%, isn't it?
No, it could be up to 13%.
It's 3%.
I thought
it's 3%.
Nailed it.
I was close by one. I was off by one digit.
Yeah.
You haven't won yet.
Bob said 3-4%, so he was right. It's 3%. But if you pull decaffeinated coffee off the store shelf or order it in a store, in Dunkin' Donuts or whatever, and you test how much caffeine is in there, what kind of results do you get?
50%.
23%.
Anywhere from 3 to about 20%. And it's not clear why that is. It should all be 3% if it says decaffeinated. So it's just, they don't do a good job of keeping it separate. You know, whether they're making a pot of decaf and a pot that previously had regular coffee in it, it's just getting mixed, or it's like that in The Simpsons. You know, you have the dark beer, the light beer, and the whatever, and it's all coming from the same feed. You know, into the different buckets.
Yeah.
You guys remember that? It's probably not that bad. But all right, let's move on to number two. Chemists have developed a process for making a strong alcoholic beverage from coffee grounds. You guys also think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Good job, everyone. You got me this week. Yeah, so I do think, however, that they cheated a little bit.
Of course.
Because they added sugar and yeast. And won't that make alcohol out of anything?
That's what I was saying.
Yeah, sugar and yeast.
That's what the prisoners do.
It's not like the alcohol is made from the coffee grounds. It's made with the coffee grounds.
Yes, with.
But
right.
But that's what they said. They make it from coffee grounds. But I just think by adding yeast and sugar, okay. But you do end up
with pour alcohol on the coffee grounds. And you have alcohol.
But then they do concentrate it. You know, they do ferment it. They heat it. They concentrate it. You end up with a beverage that's 40% ethanol.
Woo.
And that has a very strong, bitter coffee taste.
I bet.
Pungent, taste. But palatable,
sounds
apparently.
Sounds horrible.
Yeah.
Better than civet coffee.
Civet.
I don't know, have you ever had civet coffee?
Heard it's good.
No.
Supposedly it's the best in the world.
Yeah. So all of this means that new research finds that pregnant women who drink coffee daily have a significant increase in the risk of certain birth defects is the fiction. You guys all sniffed that out. There isn't any connection between coffee drinking or caffeine intake and birth defects. Although the standard recommendation is for women to limit their caffeine use, their coffee drinking to one, to two beverages a day. But a study which was in mice, not in people, and it showed that that high doses of caffeine, that could increase the risk of seizures in the mice. So not sure if that would translate to people or not, but it could.
But still,
you're left with the same recommendation. Just don't overdo it. You know, just don't drink a lot of caffeine. And but still no association with birth defects, which is a good thing.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah, you guys got me. You know, I didn't think this week was going to be challenging, but I couldn't resist. I saw three coffee-related news items. You know, I'm a sucker
for themes.
I like things about coffee.
Do it as often as you want.
Yeah. Jay, you got a quote for us?
This is a quote from a listener named John Carabake. And John, I'm not going to say anything other than I like your email address. And the quote is, "Simplicity and beauty are the signs, not of truth, but of well-constructed, approximate model of a limited domain of phenomena. You like that quote, guys?
Who said that?
Lee Smolin!
Lee Smolin.
Lee Smolin is an American theoretical physicist, a faculty member at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an adjunct professor of physics at the University of Waterloo, and a member of the graduate faculty of the philosophy department at the University of Toronto. And he also wrote the book which this is taken from, and the book is called Time Reborn.
Yeah, that's good. That's basically a technical description of scientific knowledge. It's pretty accurate.
Hey, I'm going to be at Dragon Con this year, which happens in Atlanta, Labor Day weekend. And I just want to give a quick shout out to the Atlanta Star Party, which happens every year. They raise money to fight leukemia. AtlantaStarParty.com. It's the night before Dragon Con starts. And you should go and bring all your friends. It's a good time.
Yeah, the rest of us, unfortunately, are going to miss it this year. We're going to miss Dragon Con, which is unfortunate. We always have a lot of fun there. We were too busy doing things like, you know, filming Ock and other projects.
Yeah, we'll have to get you there next year.
Yep, definitely. But you have a good time, Rebecca. Represent.
Thank you. I will.
Yep.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.